So, Tim, on our last episode, we ended up taking a detour, the scenic route, through the land of the parachurch and commenting on the various things happening there. But the original plan was for that episode to be about a few good men. Where do we find young men who are gifted and called to church ministry? How do we train them? And particularly, how do we attract them to the church and not to the many other kinds of causes, organizations, and movements that are looking for those same good men, men who will have integrity, who will have drive, who will have creativity, who are willing to take risks. Those men are uniquely valuable anywhere they go. Everybody wants them. How do we get them to prioritize the church?
So I'm really excited about this subject because you may not know it, but this is the raison d'être of the church that you and I were a part of for 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
We had an elders pastors retreat near the beginning of the church. We went out to the Wegner's Chalet and we spent the day talking about what was the purpose that was unique to our church. You know, in leadership, you want to find what you do well and do it. Mm-hmm. We were talking and all of a sudden Tim Wegner, carpenter, he said, well, everybody knows what this church is about. And I said, really, what? And he said, training leaders. I've never forgotten it. Mm-hmm. The minute he said it, we all were like, well, yes, actually, that's true. Now, I can't tell you why he said that, but I can tell you that from that moment on, it has defined certainly my work.
Yeah.
So the whole question of young men and women, not just men, but women, and who marries whom, in a university community, and the call of them to serve and to love the church is an incredibly important thing for ministry at your church, Trinity Reformed Church. As a matter of fact, the whole presbytery and the church are served almost exclusively by people who came to Bloomington and were peeled off for pastoral ministry or for being married to an elder or pastor. And they're good women and good men. Very good, you know.
Yes.
Where does this commitment come from? And I want to point to a couple of things. First of all, my father and my mother were both people that raised leaders. I mean, the fact that all three of their sons became pastors and their daughter became the principal of an alternative school in the inner city of Chicago should give you some indication of their formation of leadership. My brother went to Swarthmore. He would have been a Bible translator. It was in their DNA. And I think part of it goes back to what we mentioned last time. Dad and Mud were, that's what we call my mother, Mud. We all called her that. It was respectful. Both of them were the first InterVarsity staff workers at the beginning of InterVarsity in the 40s and in Cambridge. They were the staff members for all of New England. Okay. So obviously the people they're raising are the leaders of America.
Yeah.
And so it was part of Dad's DNA. The other thing about Dad was that Dad never taught people what to think. There's a very famous reform guy that everybody likes to listen to and teach. What he does is he tells people what to think. And he's good at telling people what to think. That's never been what my father did. My father taught people how to think. And one of the ways he did that is he always made them uncomfortable. If they said something and it was the right thing to say, he'd then poke them and say, why did you say that? And how do you know? And then he'd argue with them. You don't make leaders when you tell them what to think, ever.
Yeah.
It's one of the mistakes of homeschooling and classical Christian schooling, is so often it falls into the error of telling people what to think. It was probably in my DNA and Mary Lee's DNA to be independent thinkers and to understand the necessity of arguments and controversy to the formation of anything worth holding to. It was just a part of who we were, okay? But then several things happened. One thing that happened was that when I entered the ministry, my brother Nathan gave me a book He told me he'd found it helpful and that I should read it. And this was Nathan, who died of pancreatic cancer back 20 years ago. The book was Hugh Evan Hopkins' book, Charles Simeon of Cambridge.
Okay.
I read this book, and the reason people were interested in Simeon, there's something called the Simeon Trust, that how to preach expositionally. What people don't know about Simeon is he was at Cambridge, and he got appointed. His dad worked to get him appointed to the pulpit of Holy Trinity in Cambridge. He was 23 years old when he took over this church in Cambridge. 23. Okay. And he leapfrogged the man that had been the curate. So he became the curate. The man that had been the curate was loved by the people and sidelined by this new curate coming in. But they had the ability of hiring somebody who would hold a worship service and be sort of a lecturer every Sunday and preach. And so this man that they wanted to have the curate position, they then decided to hire him to give this weekly lecture sermon and to hold the weekly sort of second worship service. They paid him twice as much as Charles Simeon was getting paid, holding his old position.
Okay.
Twice as much. Then they all locked up their pews, and when he tried to buy chairs for the people that wanted to come to his worship service, the church warden threw the chairs out in the courtyard. They did everything they could to keep anybody from coming and sitting under the preaching of Charles Simeon.
Okay.
They hated Charles Simeon. They hated him. They all went to this other guy's worship and preaching. And so what did Simeon do? Well, he began to invite the young students from Cambridge and other people to come to his apartment. And he would talk to them. Do you know that in a few decades, he had filled a huge number of the pulpits of the Anglican Church in England?
Really?
Yeah. And so reading that biography was formative for me at the beginning of ministry, because immediately the conflict that's required being a pastor, you can't escape conflict and be biblical. You just can't. And so I fell in love with Charles Simeon and his whole view of how to raise up leaders.
Now, it's a little bit odd to become a senior pastor of a church at 23. Mm-hmm. Doesn't that seem a bit out of sorts?
Well, his father was friends with the bishop and got the appointment for him.
Doesn't that seem a bit out of sorts?
What was Jonathan Edwards' dad?
Yeah.
Why did his dad start Yale? To train his son to be a pastor. Half the men at Harvard were pastors, trained to be pastors. So, and if you look in Scripture again and again and again, there is father to son of leadership. So it's natural and has always been the case that men in the pastorate are very frequently the sons of pastors or grandsons. And you look at Edwards, his maternal grandfather. His mother had grown up in a pastor's home.
Yeah, I think I just have an American sensitivity to nepotism, and the idea that things are, that positions of power or authority are inherited, runs directly against. Now that's not what we're saying, but that's how it strikes me as.
I'm very sensitive to that because my father was hired at David C. Cook Publishing, and the guy that ran the place was Lee Vance, who was the son-in-law of the predecessor CEO. And David C. Cook III, if I remember correctly, was the man that was running the company, and he was not, shall we say, competent. And so my father spent a number of years working with a couple of other men on the board to change it so it wasn't from father to son to son. And so when my father-in-law, Ken Taylor, hired Mark out of Duke to come and work with him at the company, Mark didn't want to do that. But out of honoring his father, he came and did it. And he was a godsend to the company because he was calm and not didn't have the sort of inclination of making financial overcommitments to overseas missions. Dad Taylor gave every bit of the money that he made personally through his company, he just gave it away. And he'd almost bankrupted Tyndale House, and Mark brought fiscal discipline in. And I remember my dad saying to me, just disapproving of the fact that Mark was going to come and work under his father because of nepotism, okay? And I remember saying to my dad, it's good. In this case, it's good. You know, you don't often have a principial difference. My dad had this guy that he worked under for years, and the guy kept saying he was going to make my dad CEO. And my dad ended up calling this guy Armand Hammer. Do you get the illusion? No. Occidental Petroleum. This is a guy that was CEO into probably his 90s. And so it was my dad's way of saying, I'm never going to get out from under this. So, yeah, I understand the whole American, you know, raise yourself by your own bootstraps, not by your dad's bootstraps.
Yeah.
But I just got done saying to your son who came in to visit us, yep, what are you going to do when you grow up?
Yep.
You know, most men want to do what their dad does because they love their dad and they just want to be like him. And he's sitting there nodding his head and smiling. So what are you going to do with that?
Well, I consciously, as a business founder, don't want to presume that my children will necessarily want to run my business.
I understand that because I ministered in a farming community and my best elder had been pressured to come and take over the family farm. He had not wanted to do that, but in honoring his father, he did it. That is a very frequent problem in farming. Now, although now we're factory farming, but family farms.
Interestingly, a lot of Japanese companies have a really weird approach to this, which is the thing I've learned as I've been studying lean manufacturing and the whole growth of Japanese manufacturing in the late 20th century, is that many of these companies are family owned for 100 years or more, but they select a new CEO and then they adopt him into the family.
Seriously,
adoption of adult men into the family to be able to have a merit based family past, like it's,
I thought
still,
we called that the mafia.
I don't know what you call that. It's an extremely interesting, different kind of solution.
So going back to Simeon, what I learned was that you can fill the pulpits of England with young men who went off to the university and were leaders by teaching them scripture, meeting with them regularly in your own home, and forming them at their most, the most important time of their life. And when you think about what we as Christian parents do so often is we send our children off to our alma mater, our nursing mother, literally, and what we're really doing, so say a Wheaton grad, you know, they had a good experience at Wheaton, so they just live for their children to grow up and go to Wheaton, right? Mm-hmm. And it's called legacy admissions. And the reason we do that is for a number of reasons, but I think that in many cases, the main reason is we want them to marry somebody whose parents also went to Wheaton, because that takes care of so many cultural conflicts, just that all sets of parents went to Wheaton. I mean, it really is a huge part of people sending their children to the college they went to, because generally the college you choose says a world of things about your parents and about you, what your socioeconomic level is, whether you're wired for Purdue or IU. You know, are you an engineer or are you an artiste? Whether you like Mitch Daniels or whether you like, you know, one of the, I mean, I could keep going, but the point is you get them at college and you have an incredibly important time in lives. But the problem is when you go to college, what happens is the professors try to break you down. They want you to be a different person when you leave than when you came. And so, for instance, James Davidson Hunter, I think University of Virginia sociologist, wrote a book called Evangelicals in the Coming Generation, where as a sociologist, he did a thoroughgoing study of all the colleges that were in the Christian Coalition of Colleges, Evangelical Higher Education Association. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's filled with graphs and statistics and everything. And it was published originally by the University of Chicago. And what he shows is that Christian colleges consistently liberalize the children of conservative parents. That the children come in not going to R-rated movies, for instance. And every year, further year, they have at a Christian evangelical school. And of course, Wheaton's a perfect example. They become more and more and more liberal. So what the professors actually do in terms of spiritual and doctrinal and ethical commitments is they break down the commitments that are biblical of the parents and change them in the children. And so good professors, and this is kind of ironic for me to say good, what they live to do is to question every position held by the students that they get a hold of until those students are so broken down by their professors that they allow their professors to give them a new set of convictions. And that's central to that period of time. And that's why people give all their money to their alma mater. They don't give it to their Christian high school. You know, it's ludicrous. All the money goes to colleges and universities. And it's because their lives have changed at their alma mater.
Yes.
Everybody knows that goes on, right?
My life changed in college dramatically.
Yeah. But now here's the deal. Why shouldn't the pastors of the church they attend in college be the one that changes them? Why shouldn't the pastor in the church and the elders and the older women of that church that form their wives, why shouldn't they be the ones that the commitment is undying to on the part of the college students and uni students that go there? We never think about that. But why allow, you know, the wicked professors at Indiana University to form the children of Christian parents more than their pastors and elders? Think about that.
Yeah.
Reading Simeon made me realize there's more than one way to skin a cat. You've got aristocracy sending their kids off to Cambridge to be prepared to be aristocrats, right? But why not peel them off to become pastors? Why not teach them that it's an unbelievably, eternally important thing to preach and give pastoral care to the sheep of Christ's church than it is to go off and, you know, to be a colonial ruler in India or to, you know, be a diplomat or to be... Now, at this point, a lot of people are going to say to me, well, Luther teaches us that all callings are equal. And we should not have the medieval Roman Catholic view that it's really the real Christians are, you know, the religious and like monks and nuns and priests and bishops. And everybody else is just a flunky and they're not really quite Christians because they're not religious.
And yeah. Then you look, if you were a good Christian, you'd do it full time.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And then you go back to the Pharisees and scribes and Sadducees and the sinners that they refer to, all they are is uneducated and poor Jews. Mm-hmm. And so you really, in their view, needed to be a religious, same as the medieval Roman Catholic Church, if you were going to be holy. And all the laws were set up in such a way that only somebody whose whole life was devoted to keeping them, you know,
yeah,
was able to do it. And so everybody else was a sinner.
Yeah. If the law said you had to eat free-range, organic, gluten-free, the only folks who can afford that.
That's right. That's right. Or speak with a British accent and have a PhD or a THD. Okay.
Yep.
And so you get my point. My point is we need to consciously think of major universities, Christian colleges, and we need to fight to keep the professors at Christian schools and secular schools from ruining our children. And the way to do that is make a choice of where you send your children based on the church and make sure that the pastor of that church knows that you want him to be a parentis in absentia, an absent parent in their behalf. And so I began to do that at this church. And every time I had parents come to visit their children, I would take them aside and I would say to them, I want you to know that my children are younger now, or my children are in high school, my children are in college, and I have every bit the same commitment to your children that you do. I'm not their parent, but I am trying to do everything I can to make sure we as a church do what you would want us to do in caring for your son and your daughter. Always did that with parents. Mm. And about 12 years ago, a man had an assistant working with him at his church. His assistant came out to one of our conferences, and at the end of the conference, he went back home, and he sent me an email. He said, Tim, I would like to have a meeting with you by phone because I have a question I'd like to discuss with you. So we set up an appointment, we got on the phone, and what was his question? His question was, Tim, how does your church raise up leaders? I was there, and I met them. And I was impressed of all the young men there who are leaders. The nub is we discipline them and rebuke. And I'm laughing because it's the very opposite that anybody would think would draw men and would make them want to take on your work and be your son. Because we think we have to flatter them. We have to think we have to cuddle them and coddle them. But the fact is, men...
Cuddle them, coddle them, curdle them.
Yeah, curdle. Cool. Yeah, leave them out of the refrigerator.
So rewinding, there were a couple of things that you'd said earlier that I wanted to come back and touch on briefly. In our previous episode, we talked about Mark Driscoll, and I particularly remember reading him commenting on a certain category of young men at his church who were willing to take risks, willing to try new things, willing to think on their feet, but they were not well-trained, not yet wise. He called them colts. They're wild, they're energetic, they have to be carefully trained, and they have to be broken in. But you cannot keep them in a paddock forever. They have to have room to run. And if your church doesn't have a plan to either move them up and give them more and more responsibility, they are going to leave. And if they leave because you send them, it will be good. And if they leave because they realize that your church is a dead end because they'll never be given any real responsibility till they're 50, then it's bad.
Okay, let's talk about that. But I want to make sure everybody heard. You will not be able to have the loyalty and love of young men
if you don't discipline them.
If you don't discipline them. And of course, disciplining them obviously involves giving them very real responsibility and letting them fail. Mm-hmm. In other words, what you said is absolutely right, okay?
Yeah.
Let me give you an example. In our church, we had a young man who had been involved in leadership but had not been willing to put women willy-nilly over men in authority, which the national office required of him. Mm-hmm. He said some things to one of the elders of our church that were extraordinarily inappropriate. And when you have men who are in the pastor's college being trained for ministry who are inappropriate in the way they speak and relate to an elder of your church, this is Houston, we have a problem. And this man had the presumptuous commitment to point out a failure that was pretty central to the man's life, to this man. And I heard about it, and of course I chuckled. And I chuckled because... you know, it's a colt. He's bumptious. He's Tigger, you know? And he's just trying to be a leader. I don't know where I got it from, but somebody I worked with called them thunder puppies.
Yep.
And that's a perfect term for them. And you'll have a steady succession of them coming into your church. And if you preach in a way that they can't believe they heard what you just said, which actually is much calmer than what Luther and Calvin said in their sermons, yeah, but they've never heard in an evangelical church, then they go on campus and they begin to preach and say that, like, queers, you know, should repent. Now, we haven't had quite that, but you get the idea. You know, they'll use the language that shocks people, they'll this, that, and the other thing. And so when I came back into town, I ran into him in the foyer, and I said to him, listen.
Buddy.
Well, I smiled at him.
Yeah.
And what had happened was the elder... when he said what he said to this elder, and this elder is about the most gentle man on the face of the earth, very humble, very kind, very, very loving. And when he said what he said to that elder, you know how the elder responded? The elder said to him, you are an asshole. And when I heard that, I was like, no.
You made who say what?
No, I couldn't believe that's what the elder had said, you know. And so I went up to him and I said to him, you know, when so-and-so, say John Doe, you know, when John Doe says to somebody, you are an asshole. And immediately he looked at me and he said, he probably is. And I started laughing.
Yep.
Now think about this. What does it teach? Well, I'm not trying to teach anybody to use that word. But if you take a man who is perfectly self-controlled, perfectly disciplined, perfectly humble, perfectly meek, he's an elder of my church. I know him. And this man
pushes his buttons that hard
and inappropriately, and he says that to him, this is a time to celebrate.
What are we celebrating, Tim?
What we're celebrating is that a young man makes a mistake that causes serious pain in a variety of relationships of the church. And so what ended up happening is the pastors of the church then removed him from the work he had been involved in. And so he got disciplined, but I laughed. Because to me, it was so incongruous that this particular elder had said that. And I thought that my laughter would signal two things to him. Number one, our goal is not to cause our young men to be safe.
Yep.
We want them making mistakes. And that's not the end of the road for him. And this man is now involved in leadership at another church and is very helpful to the pastor. And he's grown in his ability to handle conflict, to fail. He's not as insecure as he was, okay? Mm-hmm. Are you with me? The second thing is, I wanted him to know that what he did was wrong. Sometimes you'll go to a young buck, you know, a thunder puppy, with something like that, and he'll then proceed to defend himself. You remember Phil Henry preached his first sermon at our church. Do you remember this?
I was not there.
Oh, you were not there. So he preaches the first sermon. He goes out to Westminster and Escondido then for training afterwards. His first sermon, I get back into town, and what the elders tell me is he preached an hour and 37 minutes his first sermon. People were strangling. I mean, it was like, and when I talked to Phil about it, he didn't really realize that that was inappropriate.
Mm.
And so I started to sort of make fun of him. I said, you know, Phil, you could fly up to Chicago and get to a dentist and have a root canal and get back to Indy in the time it took you to finish your, I mean, that was a bit of an exaggeration. Yeah.
Phil,
you know?
Get to the point.
Yeah. And Phil kept it. And finally I said, Phil, stop. What you did was wrong. Now, there are some colts, some thunder puppies that you have to be that. But I started out with him thinking he would realize that he had really sort of blown it, stepped in it. And so I started out laughing with him, too. I tell those stories, but I have a third one. When a number of musicians came to our church, we gave them the mandate of writing music that included the themes of God's judgment, of heaven and hell, of God's law. In other words, music that matched the Psalter, the Psalms. And specifically, I gave to those men a couple of songs from colonial New England that were about judgment, typically surrounding Thanksgiving Day, the harvest. And I said, write some music that brings men back to understanding the musical worship of the church, because it brings in heaven and hell. It brings in judgment. I don't want all this subjective stuff anymore, like you said Hillsong and you said Bethel or something.
There's a whole bunch of different.
Okay. They began to write music. They began to write arrangements of historic hymns. As they began to lead our worship, of course, because we had so many classical musicians, typically we had had highbrow music. You know, we'd had a piano played by very good pianists. Then when we did switch to a guitar, it was acoustic, and it was played by a classical guitarist. And so you could sing four-part harmony with everything he played and never have his guitar, you know, dissonant with what your part was you were singing. But it meant he was changing his chords every half second. You know, remember that? With
I remember that.
Yeah. You want to describe it in a musical way? I'm not a musician.
I mean, he would essentially convert piano arrangements to guitar and play them with all the complicated chord structures fully intact so that every individual line was voiced throughout. It was a lot. As a bass player, I'm like, hey, can I hang out on this pedal tone? No. You have to play the entire bass line from the hymnal, otherwise you're going to clash.
So then you guys formed yourself in a Good Shepherd Band. You began to write music. You began to write arrangements. Hmm. And what happened was we moved into a new facility that had horrible acoustics.
Still does.
Yeah, it does. It has a threshold. They place the HVAC units on the roof, and it has a threshold of 65 decibels in the sanctuary. 65. That's where you start trying to amplify. The amplification has to be substantial in order to be heard, plus the acoustics at the beginning were horrible. There were no acoustic tile kind of things, no efforts to cut. It had about a three-second echo, which is perfect for an organ, but not perfect for bass drums.
Great for a choir.
Yeah, great for a choir, too.
Terrible for electrified instruments.
So what happened was you guys played loudly, and you were amplified. And immediately, I began to get all these complaints. And it was intense. I don't know if you remember.
I remember.
It was intense.
I was the one who had to play guitar solos. I remember.
Yeah, it was intense. And a lot of the people that had been there from the beginning, so they antedated the young men, were not happy. And they began to make comments like, this is going to hurt my eardrums. I'm wearing, earplugs, and I am against it and against it and against it. And a lot of these people actually had a background in classical music. Mm-hmm. Curtis Cook, for years at the beginning, did not like it.
Yeah.
And he's a bass opera singer. And so the question was, will we as elders tell you to turn the volume down? We didn't. But why didn't we? Was it because the conflicts? No, the conflict continued. It continued, I want to say, for a year and a half to 2 years. It got to the point where I read up on decibel levels, and we bought a decibel meter, mm-hmm. a sound meter, and we began to place it at different points in the church and find out what the level of decibels was. Then we found out that a symphony orchestra was still louder than what you guys were in the band, because they run, 110, 120 sometimes?
They can.
Yeah. And then you find out what the level of a telephone was before cell phones, when you put it up to your ear. And then you find out what the level of a jet taking off is, and all these different things, because we had to argue it. And what we found was that the decibel level of our band playing in worship was very, very analogous to a number of levels of sound in common life. Then, one point, I went to 10th Prez when their music director was Paul Jones. Well, Paul Jones had written a book about how you should never have any electrical instruments in worship except the blower for the organ, of course. So I went there, and it happened to be a special Sunday where Paul Jones had pulled out all the stops in his musical leadership. He was running from the front to the back to the front, playing the organ and this, that, and the other thing. And he had taken a position opposing any use of electrical instruments in Reformed worship, right? So I was very aware. Well, what I noticed was that they had, for their anthem, they had the choir in the back balcony, and they had all kinds of instruments, and they had extremely loud kettle drums. Now, how loud are kettle drums?
Having sat fairly close to them at the back of a viola section, they're loud.
They're very loud. Louder than our drums. And so why did we not tell you guys to be quiet? Well, number one, because just factually, the opponents of you were wrong. We used a decibel meter, and we told them they were wrong. Okay? Number two, even the guys who had written about how evil electric instruments are were wrong, mm-hmm. because they were hypocrites. They did it the same volume level as, well, drums are drums, drums are drums. But the main reason was that it was just so clear that if we came into these musicians who were classically trained, and so would you tell people what the classical training was of all of you in the band?
So the Good Shepherd Band included a number of guys who had graduate or doctoral level degrees. I had my undergrad in viola performance. Phil had come as a doctoral student in choral conducting, also a gifted pianist. Jody had done his graduate work in England in early music violin, Baroque violin, and had come to IU to get his doctorate in early music, I believe under Stanley Ritchie at IU, which was one of the most well-known programs in early music. IU has always had a very big early music program. I think our keyboard player, Aaron Jones, was at the time taking graduate level harpsichord performance lessons. Mm-hmm. We had a whole lot of classical nerdery in that group. And it wasn't because we didn't understand musical styles that we ended up playing as we did.
Yeah, you did it because you were asked. And when you were asked, among the elders, was one guy that had come just close to the end of getting his doctorate in musicology, Wayne Huck, who had finally decided that he was not going to get his doctorate. He'd passed his exams. Everything was done. And then he backed out. Brilliant guy. And then we had David Canfield. Tell them about David Canfield.
David is a prolific composer of all different kinds of classical music for different instruments, and also is one of the world's preeminent collectors and catalogers of vinyl recordings of classical music.
And his pieces have been performed all over the world.
Yeah.
These were the men that made the decision we're going to go to. And you know why? Because the Reformers had a principle of the simplification of music, and they had a principle of lingua franca. When it came to music, when it came to the translation of scripture,
mm-hmm.
simplicity and understandability. Stephen Baker said to me one day, you realize that the rhythm guitar is the organ. And all of a sudden, it just clicked. It just clicked. You men, it was humiliating for you to go to electric instruments. But it did enable the church and people from the university who were not musicians to get their fingernails into crevices of Reformed, conscientious, historic worship, preaching everything.
Mm-hmm.
And we made no sacrifices over the lyrics. And that group ended up becoming My Soul Among Lions and have now done how many psalms?
Close to 40 at this point.
Close to 40 psalms. Which, if you don't know, the recordings go online. Look up My Soul Among Lions and just listen to the songs. They're incredibly good and so masculine. So the men have a place to be.
Now, all that is an example of a place where you're giving young men leadership. You're letting them take risks.
And it could
some
have
of
been.
Those risks didn't pan out great. Do you remember the kazoo? There was one particular song.
Do you know why you use the kazoo? I know why you use the kazoo.
Oh, why do you think we used the kazoo?
Oh, I know why you did it. Because that was my favorite hymn. And you did it to keep it from being like this heavy thing. We had sung that for years, a cappella, in our Bible studies up in the barn.
Yep.
We had, and I loved it. And it was a poke in the eye of Tim Bailey. Everybody got such delight out of doing it with a kazoo.
That was a lot even for us. We all every Sunday that we did that, we looked at each other at soundcheck and are like, are we really doing this again? And we later moderated it and we had saxophone play that line. And everyone agreed that was much better.
Yeah. And again, that's what young men do, is they make fun of you and they do things you don't like. But it was absolutely clear to us that we could not come in and tell you how to handle your volume. We couldn't, because it would take your initiative and discourage it. My dad had a rule about delegating responsibility that when you delegate responsibility, don't ever take it back. And what that means is let them fail. I knew the whole time that we could have said the word and you guys would have toned it down just a little and the criticism would stop. I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to make that decision. I wanted you guys. And it was true. A couple years later, the sound got down just a little and it was enough that you didn't have your hair stand on end mm-hmm. anymore. But the other thing I noticed was that young people will show a zeal that older men don't have. And part of the reason that it was so good was the volume you played and the way you led was as if you were at the front of a marching phalanx in Rome. I mean, you guys were forcing the congregation to worship with you, and part of that was the volume.
Yeah.
Now, do you want to say anything about that?
Christian musicians always have a complex about playing at church. I had a complex about playing at church. Like, I want to pursue excellence. I want people's attention on me. I want them to be impressed by the work that I've done and the technical excellence of my performance. And then you get into church and you're supposed to want to be invisible. You're supposed to want to be up in the balcony behind the church congregation. You want to be heard but not seen. There's all this inner conflict over, I mean, I still don't like playing guitar solos in the middle of songs at church. I understand why structurally, musically, it's there, but I don't particularly enjoy that often. And I often wish that we didn't have as many guitar solos in many of those songs. But it has definitely been good for me to know that I have a conscious responsibility to be leading the people in worship, not just by providing an opportunity for them to sing a song, but by leading and instructing their emotions and their bodies in how they ought to worship.
You know, you talk about guitar solos, and I waited for you forever to be willing to play lead, and then forever to be willing to turn it up and to actually do it the way it's done. The normal response of musicians in our church to leading musically has been not wanting to do it. Mm. I remember Don, who was the best by far soprano in the music school for several years. She got all the leading roles, did an internship at the San Francisco Opera. I remember Don coming to me and saying she didn't want to sing anymore. Why? Well, because it's all vanity. Everybody is trying to promote themselves. I'm so sick of it. And she was ready to give up singing. And I remember Marcos Cavalcante, who was a Brazilian jazz guitarist. Mm-hmm. And he was at the very top. I mean, he got, I don't know what it was, a performance.
Probably an artist diploma.
Yeah, that's what it was, an artist diploma. A couple of times I mentioned him, you don't ever play at church. Why not? He said, because everybody worships guitarists. And he said, I don't ever want people thinking about me during the music of the church. He said the thing he most hated was when keyboardists or bands would play behind a prayer. And he said, I can tell you by the progression and the chord.
Exactly what they're trying to elicit.
And yeah. So we've had a lot of musicians who have not wanted to use their gift in the church, but are very willing to use it at the music school, at auditions, at concerts, and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And that's so perverse because, my goodness, can't St. Matthew's be performed in the church? You know, can it be written for the church's worship? You know, the main point of telling all this story about music and artists in the church is, you know, Carol, David Canfield's wife, was trying to get me to allow the choir to go to the balcony where they wouldn't be seen. And I was like, no, you're not going to do that. Oh, yes, yes. The people shouldn't even see us. And I wasn't getting anywhere arguing with Carol. And finally, I said to her, Carol, I think maybe you're right. And I'm going to preach up in the balcony where nobody can see me from now on. And she just about croaked, you know, no, you can't do that. And I said, sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander.
Yeah.
You know, why you and not me? Well, because that's a central part of preaching. I said, it's an essential part of leading the music. Your faces lead us. We love you. You encourage us to worship God with more fervor. So I think that you have to have young men not only called to be disciplined by the elders and pastors of a church, but then you have to give them serious responsibility. And then you have to take your hands off. And then you have to be very tolerant of their mistakes.
Yeah. The flip side of, so last thing on the guitar solos is, it's fine to have guitar solos And it's fine to not have guitar solos.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fine to have guitar solos and mail them in. If you're going to do it all the way to the back wall. If you're not going to do it, fine, don't do it.
Yeah.
But don't half-ass it.
Yeah.
But on the...
I want to explain about your guitar solos. They're almost identical to sopranos singing descant and to organs transitioning to a higher key. You know how organs will do that. They'll sometimes for 30 seconds go off just to signal you that they're going to raise you one.
Yeah.
You know, and so don't get snooty that a guitar solo is inappropriate, but descant is okay. Descant calls attention to itself every bit as much as a guitar solo does. And if you say there should never be instruments playing without singing, organs do it all the time. So do pianists if they want to raise it a key.
Yep.
And then there's the prelude and the offertory, and a lot of people would say, well, you shouldn't have preludes. You shouldn't have it. All should be singing. It's like, oh, yeah. So a violin and a viola can't sing? Well, they don't sing the words. Well, everybody knows the words, you know. My Jesus, I love thee. I know thou art mine.
Yeah, the ability of a melody to bring the words to mind is substantial. When it comes to giving young men real responsibilities and then not pulling those back, how do you give young men work to do without it turning into asking them to make bricks without straw? What do you have to give them in order to have them actually have a chance to succeed?
You don't want them to succeed. You want them to grow. If your expectation is that they will succeed, really, that's sort of a subtle indication that you don't want them to grow into a leader. You just want them to take care of parts of your job or parts of other people's job that are beneath you.
Yeah, let me rephrase that. There are things you can give them to do where you only set them up for failure.
Okay, give me an example.
Well, one would be if you just offload things that you don't want to deal with, that you don't think there's actually a good way to handle. You're just like, hey, you go in there and be cannon fodder on this or that problem. Good luck.
Yeah. We did that to Wayne Huck. Have I ever told you about that?
Was that the piles of documents in his back? Yeah.
He's going to sell his car or something, and he's depressed having to clean it. So I went out to clean his car with him. He opens up the back door, and it's absolutely filled to the brim with session, with elders, documents, minutes, everything. And all of a sudden, I looked at Wayne, and I said, you know, Wayne, I have to apologize to you. You know what you are? You're the dumping ground for everything nobody else wants to do. And so we just give you the nasty jobs or all the jobs, and here you feel guilty, and that's good for you and good for us. You can feel guilty.
Set down an action item for Wayne. And while you're doing that, could you put down inside that action item an action item for Wayne?
Yeah, I mean...
To follow up with Wayne and make sure Wayne's doing the action item that we assigned to Wayne.
Well, no. We got it out of our hair. And truth be told, a number of the things, we were happy to never hear about him again. And then,
oh, no. Yeah, you assign him to follow up with himself.
The entire thing.
And if you find that Wayne has not successfully accomplished it, then can you have Wayne discipline Wayne? Okay, so... We'd been talking about music. We'd been talking about giving them responsibility and not giving them tasks that don't have a possible solution to them, not setting them up only to fail. But you said you wanted to make a distinction between succeeding and growing. Can you expand that a little bit? Like if a young man comes in and he's a thunder puppy, and I believe that term actually came from Doug Wilson. I'm pretty sure I've read it there before. But if a young man comes in and he's a thunder puppy, but he does have real potential to grow and be a leader, and you want him to grow, his shortest path there is not going to be a string of unbroken successes.
Yeah, so what? Yes, I agree. So what?
So how are you how do you prioritize him growing? How do you choose what responsibilities to give him and how much failure to let him taste if the goal is to get him to grow?
You know, I don't think there's an answer to that. I think when my dad said, never take the responsibility back once you've delegated it, I think you could take that to its extreme and never take the responsibility back and just have them utterly fail.
Yeah.
You have to be willing to keep track of what's going on with the guy and have some awareness. I tell pastors that the job of the senior pastor head of staff is to defend the other pastors.
Air cover.
There should never be situations where a pastor explains a failure in a part of the church's leadership by saying, well, you know, that was Lucas Weeks, or that was Jody, or that was Jake, or that was Alex. You know, it's such a pathetic thing. If you're going to be the one that is responsible for the people you're delegating responsibility and authority to, their mistakes need to be your mistakes.
The buck stops with you.
And you need to protect them. If you don't protect the people that you're training to be leaders and shepherds, they'll become discouraged. I'm so concerned about people who get trained to be a pastor and they go into their first church and they get eaten alive. And there are so many men who left seminary, left Bible college, and took their first church. And there was some nasty rich man. It's so often the rich men. Oh, my goodness. And they just eat the person alive, you know? And then I say to the man, and I say to the people that love him, do not put him in another place like that one. Okay? Yeah, you're right. They have to have some feeling of God using them. Okay, let me illustrate this in two ways. From the very beginning, our seminary, Pastor's College, has had a commitment to having all the students in the Pastor's College come to every elders meeting of our church. Now, they occasionally miss it to meeting, youth group, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. They don't sit in the front circle. They sit in the back circle, all right? And they may not speak unless they raise their hand to me, the moderator, and I recognize them. And some of them, I don't recognize them, you know. I just won't.
Waving, nothing.
And
nothing.
I want the elders to know that it doesn't matter. They're sitting behind them. But why did I do that? Why was that so firm with me? Well, the reason is I know they're going to leave. And they're going to go into churches where their elders are going to tell them that they can't do any rebuking, any censuring, any discipline, anything of helpful instruction. And so I want them to experience during the 3 years they're going through the seminary, monthly, at least monthly, watching elders spend an entire meeting not talking about money, not talking about schedules, not talking about facilities, spending almost the whole time discussing different individuals in the church and who needs to go to talk to them about what and how to separate this small group where there are some bad tendencies and how. It's pastoral work.
Yeah.
Because nobody would believe that a church of our size, you know, 400 people, would constantly be doing that as elders. Okay? Mm-hmm. And I wanted those men to have the encouragement of having experienced success. And by success, I only mean that we do the work we're supposed to be doing and we don't lose our time doing financial and administrative. Now, they have to do that work too occasionally, but it's far and away a microscopic part of our work mm-hmm. at that church. And so that's a success for them. Do you understand that? Even though yep. they're not the ones that are doing it, they enter into it and they love it because they leave the training knowing that that is possible. So that's one way that you encourage young men to take in leadership, by letting them observe. They see all the fights. They see the elders that are passive-aggressive. They see me have to come to the next meeting and apologize for something that I did. You know, they see every bit of it. There are times we go to executive session when somebody needs confidentiality and discipline. Mm-hmm. All right. But they see all of us make you-know-whats of one another, argue with one another, sometimes get really irritated, argue again. You know, they see the man that makes the motion that we do such and such fail year after year after year and take it and not get bitter and not have a become a poison pill,
yeah.
but be humble. So that's the first thing. The second thing I've been wanting to tell is an account when I was working under Bob Erder at First Presbyterian Boulder. And Bob was an excellent leader. Very, very good senior pastor. The church was probably 1,500, 2,000, took up a city block downtown Boulder, right across from Liquor Mart. Very wealthy, very sophisticated in terms of the scholars and academics that were elders and pastors there. Well, they had one guy who was a professor of nuclear physics, and he was involved in the nuclear energy industry. But he had had polio, and his legs were very harmed. And so he only got around, really, with using his feet sort of as pivot points. And his real work was his polio crutches and swinging himself.
Yeah.
And he had the most sweet wife on the face of the earth. I was teaching an adult Sunday school class on Christian ethics. We dealt with euthanasia, with abortion, with nuclear energy, with war, with nuclear warfare, with a whole bunch of different issues every class. And when it got to nuclear war and nuclear energy, we had the Rocky Flats, which made the plutonium triggers for nuclear bombs right outside of Denver near us. Some of our people in our church worked there. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Catholic lay workers were protesting by laying across the railroad tracks going in and out of Rocky Flats. It was a real live issue. And so you had Christians condemning Christians, committing civil disobedience over it. And so I wanted to do a class on it. I asked this man who was an elder, I said, would you come and would you teach a class on why you as a Christian believe in nuclear energy and are involved in the industries? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And I really liked him and his wife. But then he said to me, but when I do this, he said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring in a movie that we've made of crashing a container for the waste from nuclear energy into the wall of a cliff at high speed. And everybody in the class will really like that. And I said, no, I don't want you to do that because I want this to be why you, given the realities of the nuclear industry, are mm-hmm. committed to it as a Christian. I want this to be your confession of faith as to why this is right and proper for you to do as a Christian elder.
Right.
Well, no, this movie is great. I said, no. I said, listen, maybe it's best that you not do this because I'm not willing for our class time to be taken up with that movie. Mm-hmm. Well, all right, then. He was clearly not happy with me. So Sunday came for him to do it. I come in the room, and there's a movie projector, and there's a screen. And sure enough, he does precisely what I had told him I didn't want to have done. And it probably took 20, 25 minutes of the class. And it's Sunday school, so he only had probably 50 minutes. It was the majority of the class, and it was just a movie about how safe the waste containers for plutonium and other, you know, radioactive things are when you put them on a railroad car and crash them into a cliff. Are you with me?
Yeah.
And I sat there, and I was probably, 21? I'd taken out my earring before I went to that church. Mary Lee had taken her nose ring out. We're now on the pastoral staff. Mm-hmm. And I mean, in all the pastors' meetings, we were just, and they wanted me to teach, and I was involved in training lay counselors there. So we'd given a lot of authority. This is a huge church. And I sat there and seethed. I was so angry. So when he got done and sat down, I got up and I said, thank you, Professor Smith. I said, thank you, Professor Smith. The one thing is, I'm very disappointed that precisely the thing I asked you not to do, you did, which is to show that movie. We wanted you to talk about your Christian faith and how it intersected with your profession. But instead, you showed us a movie about radioactive waste. And of course, the class was electric. This was a man with polio. This was an elder. This is a man whose wife was one of the most loved women in the whole church. And there I am, reaming him out in front of the entire class. I dismissed the class, and several people came up to me who were respectable and godly, and they laid me waste. How dare you treat him that way? You know? And I was destroyed. They were right. Well, our friends were over for lunch afterwards, and I had to walk home from the church. We only live a couple blocks away on Pearl Street. And as I walked home, I just was devastated that I had been given responsibility and authority, and I had used it to service my fit of pique, you know, my personal offense, you know. So I got home, and they were all in the kitchen eating. And I sat in the front hallway of the house, and I cried and I cried. They didn't know I was crying. But I didn't want to disappoint the people that had given me leadership, right?
Mm-hmm.
I finally knew I had to pull it together and go and have lunch. What stopped me was I realized I was only crying because I was ashamed. I wasn't crying because what I had done was wrong. And that was even more depressing. You know what I'm saying? And so I went back, and I'm sure they saw my eyes were teary, you know, and sat down. We had lunch, and then there was an evening service, and Dr. Bob was going to be preaching. So I went and stood in the employee parking lot right next to the church office and waited for him to pull in. And when he pulled in and got out, I went up to him and I said, "Dr. Bob, I'm sorry, I have something to tell you." And I described what I had done. And I said, "So I'm sorry, but I can't teach the class anymore. The failure was awful. And I apologize to you." And he said, "No, you'll keep teaching the class." And I was shocked. And then he said, "You will apologize to Professor
Smith."
Yeah. "You will apologize to Professor Smith, and then you will keep teaching." And then he used the man's first name. Let's say his first name was John. He said, "And I'm glad you did that to John."
Earlier, when you were talking about the senior pastor protecting the junior staff, the younger pastors, and giving them air cover, would you ever defend one of the younger pastors to a congregant and then turn around privately to that pastor and in nearly the same breath say, "Dude, badly done"?
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Because rarely are people offended for the right reasons. You know, I'm wondering whether to say something to you. One of the stories I've told, I've come to the conclusion that the man that I said was wrong
was right.
It needed to be done. I still do not regret saying he was wrong. I think it was good for him to be rebuked and to be removed from that particular ministry for a time, okay? I don't think he'd be the man today if that hadn't happened to him. And yet, as time went by, I realized that I thought he had more perception into that elder than I had in the situation, the specific situation. And so, yeah, you don't have to be consistent. It's the privilege of leaders to say two different things to two people, which the two people, if they talked, would say that those things are mutually exclusive. But they're not at all. Life really is complicated. History is really complicated. Can I give you an example?
Please.
Now, this has nothing to do with what we're talking about.
Okay.
But remember earlier, I think I was talking about the fact that when you read about Buswell and Machen, that they're just blood brothers. They're Siamese twins in fighting for reform. And the issues were virgin birth, the atonement, the denial of the divinity of Christ, miracles, you know, original sin. So you look at the issues that they're fighting to remove from their Presbyterian denomination.
Mm-hmm.
And it is unbelievably clear that they were right. It's unbelievably clear that biblical Christians wanted them to shut up, you know, let it all stay in the denomination, in the mission field. Nobody ever wants discipline within the church. Everybody wants to be a Christian nationalist. Everybody wants to talk about COVID and the government and the public health. Nobody ever wants to actually have the church where judgment begins, and certainly not to do it. Well, I'm reading this last week in preparation for the 13th article, and it's fascinating. I find out that one of the main reasons that everybody in the PCUSA didn't like Machen, you'd never in a million years guess. It's because Machen was opposed to prohibition.
Ha! That, I would not have gone there at all.
He was adamantly opposed to prohibition. And all the pastors, liberal and conservative, of the Presbyterian Church, were whole hog in favor of prohibition. Huh. Liberals and conservatives. Now, what is the common denominator, think about this, between liberals and conservatives both supporting prohibition? What do you think it was?
I don't know.
Both of them were deferential to women.
Teetotaling societies.
Yeah, yeah. And so often a desire to avoid offending elders' wives is more important than any doctrine. And so when Machen comes out against prohibition, people can't believe it. It is incomprehensible that a professor at Princeton, who is a conservative, who is arguing for the reform of the church,
would be in favor of drunkenness.
Yes, is in favor of drunkenness. And that was part of what ended up leading to a split.
We heard they serve bourbon for communion at his church.
I mean, and I could go more into that, but life is complicated. Yes, you can say to one person, don't do that. Don't do that. And you can say to another person, there was nothing wrong with what he did. And that's a prerogative of leaders. Leaders do not have to live in fear of others accusing them of inconsistency, unless they're preaching against adultery and they commit it. When you think about the issues of what are the seductions of young men.
When I think about the kinds of gifts, there is a tendency to treat church planting and parachurch ministry as just another form of business. And if you have a man who has entrepreneurial gifts, who's creative, who's willing to take risks, who recognizes opportunities and will go after them, that's a valuable man. That's a man that's not typical. Most men have a pretty low tolerance for risk, and it goes down as they get older, usually. So the kinds of things that I'd look at and would think would be attractive would be getting into certain kinds of business, getting into all kinds of political movements, whether they're big tent, small
tent.
That's
the big one. That's the big one. Go ahead.
But there's a blending of business and church, and a blending of politics and church that scratches that political itch, but isn't quite church. I don't use the term Christian nationalism that often. It's not a topic I discuss as such. Mm-hmm. I think it's becoming more and more commonly discussed, and it's a label that I'm starting to see secular news outlets use. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, nobody talked about the alt-right. But at a certain point, it entered the mainstream consciousness as a category, and then you had to at least be willing to discuss it, to articulate whether or not you considered yourself a part of it or not, what you thought they stood for, and where you differed from them. So the same way that the evangelical church, I think, for a long time has grown less and less willing to have men be men. And men are messy, men can be violent, men are very opinionated, men make a lot of very outre mistakes, they're just out there. It's messy. I want there to be more and more space for young men to come into the church. We've talked a lot about how reform is bloody, but there are things that you get to do as a churchman, as an elder. There are gifts that God gives you in getting to see people repent, in hearing confession of sin, in seeing marriages strengthened and restored, in seeing people turn to faith that nobody else anywhere else ever gets to see. And I would love to hear you talk more about that. Not just the combat is good, it's going to be bloody, it's going to be tough, but you should do it anyway. But there's an incredible, incredible blessing.
There's nothing that I love as much as loving Christ's church, loving my brothers and sisters in Christ, loving their children. This is the church, okay? Mm-hmm. It's what we see in Acts, the love. Jesus had prayed for it. I could go on and on and on about the joys of being a shepherd of God's sheep. Mm-hmm. And they go from generation to generation. And it's hard. Yeah, it's hard and bloody, but let's not think that anybody's sacrificing. Now we are.
Yes.
Typically financially, typically if you're faithful, all your other pastors will hate you because you're the one that makes them look bad. Because you actually preach to the conscience and discipline people, and mm-hmm. they don't. Their conscience is bad. So there are things about it that are very difficult. But I mean, you're in the church. Do you love it?
I do.
Is the love spread abroad in that church?
There's a lot of love. There's a lot of forgiveness. There's a lot of repenting.
Yeah. And I've never written about that online, but I'm gone now. I resigned the pulpit, and I could not have been more blessed by God than the people who loved Mary Lee and me and our children and cared for us. And I always told pastors who had chosen established churches, large churches, tall steeple churches,
legacy institutions.
Yeah, exactly.
And then don't rock the boat.
Like one of my friends became the senior pastor of Highland Park down in Dallas, which was Nelson Bunker Hunt's H. Ross Perot's church, you know.
You got a whale in the pews right there.
Yeah, and I've always thought about him in my final 10, 15 years, and I've just thought to myself, thank God. I was a father, and I was loved. I wasn't going to. And then I would think about my position compared to these famous, tall, steeple, rich, you know, other guys, and I would immediately realize that if I ever turned into a coward and began to pull my punches at our church, the elders and you and the other people would not stand for it. The bloom would be off the rose, and it would be time for me to leave. And I'm convinced that it would have been made clear to me. And so I not only had the love of them for me doing what I should do, I had the knowledge that if I didn't, they might very well discipline me. I'm reading Hannah Arendt's The Origin of Totalitarianism. And part I was reading this morning, she was saying that totalitarianism comes along after the people have stopped resisting. So she talks about it in terms of the Russian Revolution and Stalin. And she says the totalitarianism really comes when the conflict and opposition to Stalin as part of the trade unions and other things like that stops. And where he has nothing left to fear.
No restraint.
And then is when he becomes a demon. And so when you think about the issue of a pastor being in a church where it's not as large, it's not as wealthy, it's not as influential, and yet he is expected to preach to the conscience, the law of God as well as the grace of God. The best elder I've ever worked under, or with, was Adam Spady. Mm-hmm. What you probably don't know is that we told Adam he was not ready to be an elder. Do you know that?
Didn't know that.
Yeah. We discussed him, and we went to him. We said, Adam, you're a moralist, and so is your wife. And you need to work on that. It's a sin. You're condemnatory. And you need to get over thinking that there's always a right way to do things and that you and your wife do it the right way. And do you know, good men, young men, will grow from that kind of thing. And those that don't grow, you're done with them. I think we should get rid of the concept that every man who has real leadership gifts should be a pastor, a deacon, an elder. No, I agree. But then I want to go back to Christian nationalism and politics. I think that is the main seduction to young men who don't have chests and want to get one. And that's a condition of every young man today. It's almost never that you have a young man who is secure in his masculinity today, because fathers have abandoned raising sons. Even if they're in the home, they don't raise their sons. They let their wife determine the discipline, the level of instruction. You know, men today are all effeminate, all. Mm-hmm. None of us like the responsibility of leadership and authority. None of us like to have to lead our children and our wives, let alone a church. And so when men get convinced by the preaching of the word and teaching and instruction and seeing it in a church that they should become men, mm-hmm. they have a sense of their inadequacy as a man. Their father mm-hmm. failed him for all these reasons. So they want to prove their manhood. Mm-hmm. And what everybody tells them is, oh, you want to improve your manhood, you need to listen to, name the names, I don't know them.
I'm not sure, I mean, Joe Rogan or Andrew Tate or any of the...
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of things ranging from weird to highly toxic that are out there that are very attractive.
But let me just say this. Instead of doing names, I better stop. What really catches them is political action, because it makes the world hate them and gnash their teeth at them. And that is proof to them that they're a real man and have courage and faith.
I've gotten pushback. I must be right.
That's right. And I'm not right until I get pushback. The surefire way of doing that is to argue that Adam was not an historical person in a group of Christians who are conservative on social media, or go down and demonstrate in front of the county courthouse with your wives and little girls not wearing masks during COVID, or you talk about the millennium and the pursuit of the millennium, and you use Christian nationalism as a way of bringing in the kingdom of God, and you talk about culture a lot. In other words, nothing that is involved with reforming the church. It's all the reform of institutions, the reform of culture, the reform of government, the reform of public health, the reform of cultural understanding of masculinity, the reform of divorce laws, you know, it's all this stuff. And they get pushback. They go and preach at the abortuary, and man, it gives them such meaning in life. They're defending little babies and the mothers, you know, they're opposing Planned Parenthood. Well, never mind the fact that the majority of abortions that are committed are committed by people in the church who take hormonal birth control. The statistics on that are, that's probably more frequently the cause of abortions as surgical abortions. And so when you go to the abortuary and preach, when you go to the Capitol and testify against public health measures, when you protest at the county, all these things give a feeling of manliness to mm-hmm. young men. They listen to their pastor, and he's talking about Bible translation. And nobody else is talking about Bible translation. He's talking about the fact that the Bible has been neutered by the most conservative Bible scholars, that they've removed thousands of occurrences of words with male semantic meaning component. And he just looks cross-eyed, and he's like, you know, I think I'm going to go and preach at Planned Parenthood. And why? Well, part of it is you get immediate response at Planned Parenthood. The escorts are infuriating, you know. And you know, for years I did that, right?
Yeah.
And so you self-validate immediately. Oh, here I am, and makes you validate yourself. I mean, it's like, oh man, you know what happened to me today? Another time, you know, a full beer can comes and hits me in the chest, you know, and it's so encouraging because there you are. But then what I say to men is, okay, so you went and spoke up at a community hearing at a town council about the Civil Rights Commission and homosexuality. But let me ask you a question. Who has more courage and suffers more? The man that goes to a hearing and speaks up about human rights and sexuality, or the man who exposes Revoice? And all the leaders and rich men of his denomination come down on him with combat boots, because all the important people of the PCA are quiet about it or quietly supportive, and they're infuriated that you are publishing the fact that they're selling effeminates and gays down the river by telling them that they can stay with the temptation and identity. Now, think about this. What you have to do is interpret to young men one of the ways that you hold on to them and don't let them get involved up to their eyeballs. I mean, they're still pro-life. They still protest and everything. They still are opposed to masks. You know, we sent an appeal to our public health officers in the county saying that we were not willing to have the leaders of our worship wear masks because you can't lead without your face. Okay?
Yep.
And so we did regularly communicate to them things we would not put up with. But that was done respectfully. So we still have political positions we take very clearly. But the thing is, you have to interpret to young men that it takes more courage and faith to be a pastor and to oppose the compromises and heterodoxies and heresies in the church than it takes to talk about how bad our government is and how bad Biden is and our immigration policy. Young men will not see that. They won't see it. And so they won't want to emulate you because as far as they're concerned, you're inane. You're just talking about the church, and that doesn't matter. Are you with me?
Yeah.
So that's another way you hold on to those young men. I don't know what your response to that is.
Well, when you talked earlier about men, young men in the pastor's college observing your elder sessions and how important that was for them to see both the type and the quality and the extent of the work that was being done, I wonder how we build on-ramps and off-ramps to ministry, because there are some men who might be good, and then they have to be trained and tested, and then you decide yes or no on them. And there's a sense, I feel a sense in which when I was college age and shortly after, and some of my friends were choosing to go to the pastor's college or considering going into ministry, that there was sort of an unspoken assumption that if you choose to pursue ministry and then for any reason end up not going into it, you are a failure, you're damaged goods, you're morally defective, there's something wrong with you. And so you can't start down that path unless you already know that you're going to stick with it. Now, the question of whether a man can take on full-time vocational ministry and then after 10 years decide that he'd rather leave the pulpit and start a small business, can you leave that office? That's a separate question from how do we give young men the opportunity to see more of that work up close?
Let's deal with the second one first. There's a book called St. Paul's Missionary Methods Are Ours by Roland Allen, published maybe in the first half of the 20th century. Absolutely excellent book. And it's for missionaries.
All right.
And one of the main arguments he makes is our goal is not to recreate the cultural expression of the church that we grew up in and came from. Well, that sounds obvious, contextualization, you know. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. But one of the things he talks about is you get elders from who come to faith in your church, and you don't wait until they have the level of maturity or understanding of scripture or doctrine that the elders that you came from. I think it's one of the big failures of missions and specifically of church planning that they won't look at uneducated people, because education is so central to what the Reformed Church thinks is real church, doctrinal education. But they will get men who are obvious leaders and have the education. I would say the most frequent cause of church planning failures is promoting people into the eldership who shouldn't be. So I'm not saying that it doesn't matter who you put in, but right. I am saying that you're making sociocultural, educational class distinctions between men. And the class distinction is more important than the spiritual distinctions. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so that's the thing I would answer to your second question is you have to be capable of recognizing the gifting of the men in your church. You can't just be selecting everyone. Mm-hmm. One of our most beloved pastors in Evangel Presbytery came to us with a pierced eyebrow, bleached short hair. I think he had a post through his tongue, didn't he?
Yes.
And he'd met this sweet, violist or violinist?
Violist.
Oh, he was a violist from Biola who had come to do graduate work in a pool hall. And my wife made me tell him he had to leave and never talk to her again. It was one of the hardest walks I ever made, where my wife said, he didn't even talk to Vanessa for quite a while. They have what? How many children now?
10, I think.
Yeah, I think 10. I think she's about to give birth or just gave birth to a latest one, you know?
Yeah, I've lost track.
Yeah, yeah. And he turned out to have an almost miraculous discernment, and he'd never been to college, and he'd never had a father. And his gifting for ministry, because he just would just say the right things because he saw the issue. And he wasn't fearful. You know, if you're going to climb trees for a living,
there's certain things you get over.
And he's probably, what, 6'1", 6'2", weighs probably 300 pounds.
He's a big, strong man.
No PCA church would ever have him. No PCA presbytery would ever have him. He hasn't even been to college. And yet one of the most gifted pastors we have bears so much weight in terms of counseling problems and discipline problems and young men problems. And we need to be careful about this issue of making judgments. But now let's get to your prior question, which is the issue of what about when men fail? Is it a failure that you can't be restored from? You want to say that question again?
So what you, the way you just phrased it is not what I intended. Okay. It's not a question of a man getting into ministry and then having a failure that he can't be restored from. I'm asking, I think there are some men who could go into ministry, but it's not clear necessarily whether or not they should. And that there's some path they need to go down to find out whether they should go into ministry or not. But then if they are not suitable for it, what's the off ramp?
Yes, that's what I meant by failure. Because not suitable for it almost always involves a serious failure.
Well, if you have a man who doesn't know whether or not he wants to do ministry, and then he gets a chance to see it up close more and says, I don't want to do this. This is not what I want to do. Not wanting to be in ministry, I don't consider to be a moral failing.
No. But that's why I said you can have real leaders that you don't encourage to go to ministry, and it's not a moral failure.
Right.
So what you're talking about is,
when I asked about on-ramps and off-ramps,
using the pastor's college as a method of testing that.
Yes.
Okay. So I would say, number one, a lot of these guys you don't allow to come in. Number two, you have at the end of the first year and at the end of the second year, an evaluation by the leaders of the pastor's college and the teachers. The off-ramp is very bumpy.
Mm-hmm.
Because you all have high hopes with those men. And what people don't realize is there's a reason why you send guys off to seminary and don't do it in your church. And the reason is when you say no to men in the church, often they have a small group they lead, or they're working with the youth, or they're this, that, and the other thing. So anytime you have any kind of educational facility in the church, it adds a level of accountability. It's writing, it's reading, it's not lying about you having done the textbooks, it's turning in papers, it's all this other stuff. And so you've immediately brought in a huge area of potential conflict and alienation.
So earlier when you said there are men who have leadership gifts who should not be in ministry, what I have thought often is that the default assumption is that if you have any men in the church who are gifted for leadership, then they should go into ministry. And if for any reason they can't or don't want to, they're defective. And the question I had is, what do you say to and how do you recognize men who are gifted for leadership but ought to exercise that leadership someplace else besides vocational ministry?
There are many different kinds of leadership. The gifts that are required for somebody in pastoral leadership or eldership are diversified. If you read Martin Bucer on pastoral care, he goes through listing all the different types you need to work with you as a pastor and elder.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have them on an elder's board. But because somebody has leadership doesn't mean that that person should be an officer of Christ's church. They might be passive aggressive, but be able to run an unbelievable business. Seriously.
Fair.
They might have a wife who is constantly causing problems with the women of the church, and they might make an excellent elder. You can't have an elder or pastor whose wife is tearing down what he builds up. When Adam and Andy Halsey first came to the church, I spent a couple of two, 3 hours sitting on the lawn in front of our house talking to them as freshmen or sophomores. Got to know them, very impressed by both of them. And so when I got done talking to them, I said to them, either of you ever thought of becoming a pastor? And Andy said, well, yeah. And Adam said, no. I think we'd all agree that Adam is one of the best leaders we've ever had. And of course, I was looking to have men that would go into ministry because the way I see it, the church is desperate for pastors who will be faithful and fear God and preach to the conscience and give pastoral care. And I said to Adam, really, why not? And he said, well, when I was young, I was always in the hospital. It was very, very sick. And he said, I looked at the way doctors cared for me and were compassionate. And he said, God has called me to be a doctor. And so God doesn't just call to be a minister. Adam probably could have been an excellent minister, but God had called him, a prior call, to be a physician.
Yep.
So that's what I would say. It's not that it's the best calling. I can name names in the church. Some of them have actually said that to me. My response to them is, the question isn't whether it's the best calling. The question is whether the church is desperate for men who aren't simply entrepreneurs, who aren't simply hirelings, who aren't Tim Keller lookalikes, who aren't trying to make a ministry out of which brews they drink and being in the city for the city. The church desperately needs pastors and pastors' wives. And so you know the church. You know it's not that we don't have respect for other professions.
Right.
But how can you blame me for wanting? I always tell men who are fathers, your goal is to die well. Everything you do with your children from the time they're born should be aimed at you being able to die and having the church of Jesus Christ and its families cared for by your descendants, your seed. And why would a pastor not be that way?
He should.
Well, yeah, but you're saying it's second class and there's no good off-ramp and everybody has failed who's not a pastor and all this other stuff. And I don't look at you as a failure. Do you ever think that I think that Andrew Henry is a failure?
No, I don't. I'm saying I grew up not even really knowing that the path that I've ended up on today was even an option.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's been hilarious to watch you.
But really, like, I want to find ways to teach and encourage young men who have gifts but aren't called to ministry to still pursue those gifts all the way and really do crazy things with them. And it's not, I don't want there to be any implicit sense of, well, if you really cared about the church, you'd be a pastor. If you do anything else, it's because you care more about money or more about success or more about building a personal brand than about loving the church.
That's interesting.
But if a man doesn't want to go into the ministry, do you consider that confirmation that God hasn't called him to the ministry? I mean, Jonah didn't want to go to Nineveh.
Another man that I thought was perfectly gifted for the ministry, and when we both graduated from seminary, he didn't get any job offers. Godly, prayer, humble, meek, already had a master's in public administration, was one of my closest friends. I really got angry that God did not
give him a job position.
No, it wasn't a job. That the church couldn't be blessed with him. As I knew he would be faithful. I knew it. And I remember talking to my father-in-law, Ken Taylor, dad, and saying to Dad how upset I was that these churches just wouldn't take anybody who wasn't charismatic and larger than life. And I remember Dad saying to me, Dad had a speech impediment almost his whole life. It was almost impossible to hear him talk. He had to suck in air, so I'm going to mimic him. He said, I think that God has not called him to be a pastor. And that was so helpful to me. So when you ask me, I'm not going to say that God's called them to ministry and they haven't done it. I don't know what to say about it. They would make so much of a better pastor than I would. You know, I don't know how to deal with the issue of call. You know, it's like maybe David felt this way about all his older brothers.
Yeah.
And then you hear about Saul, and then God took his spirit from him. Maybe God has kept them Christians and sanctified them by not putting in front of them all the blandishments and temptations that there are in ministry, chief among which is pride, because you're handling the word of God and eternal souls. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But boy, I am jealous for shepherds. I am. Make no apology for that. None.
Nor should you.
Well, maybe I should.
You shouldn't apologize for being jealous for shepherds. But in the particular, there might be cases.
Yeah. I think your question was right. So do you think that God has not called them?
Out of Our Minds is brought to you by New Geneva Academy. NGA trains men for the work of ministry. If you believe you are called to the pastorate, get in touch with us. Visit newgenevaacademy.com and send us a message.